Now, this morning we want to consider several subjects, evidence supposedly supporting the theory of evolution. That is, the evidence from embryology, vestigial organs, and homology. First, I want to address myself to this question of embryology. In most textbooks used in high schools and in colleges, we find sections on embryology giving evidence supporting the theory of evolution. And very commonly we encounter the claims that there is evidence from embryology to support the theory of evolution. As a matter of fact, this theory has been thoroughly discredited many, many years ago. The problem is, once error gets in, it's very hard to get out. You see, biology books are written by people who have read earlier biology books, which were written by people who had read even earlier biology books. And once something like this gets in, it's just perpetuated. But it is a thoroughly discredited theory, totally devoid of any intellectual content. Now, this theory of embryological recapitulation, or the biogenetic law as it has been known, was popularized particularly by Ernst Haeckel, a German scientist back in the 1800s who was a rabid supporter of Darwin. As a matter of fact, Darwin said the evidence for evolution from embryology was second to none. Well, his very best evidence has been thoroughly discredited. The idea that was promulgated by Haeckel was that the human embryo, as a matter of fact, all embryos, as they develop, they recapitulate their evolutionary history. The human embryo first looks like a fish. Well, it begins as a single cell and therefore resembles that primitive form of life. And then it develops into a multicellular form, and then into something that looks like a fish, and then a tadpole, and then a reptile, and so forth and so on up the line. And so it recapitulates its development. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's the old saying, ontogeny being embryological development, recapitulates phylogeny, or evolutionary development. Well, there were contradictions and problems from the very beginning. Even back in those days, there were embryologists who were acquainted with the facts that were challenging this idea. But it became very popular, widely accepted, but today has become thoroughly discredited. For example, I have with me a paper published in Science, Volume 164, 9th of May, 1969. The article was written by Dr. Walter J. Bach of the Department of Biological Sciences of Columbia University. Dr. Bach is an evolutionist. He is reviewing some of these books, old books, on this subject. And he makes the following statement on page 684. Dr. Bach says, quote, "The biogenetic law has become so deeply rooted in biological thought that it cannot be weeded out in spite of its having been demonstrated to be wrong by numerous subsequent scholars," unquote. That is, scholars subsequent to Darwin and Haeckel and others. It has been demonstrated to be wrong by numerous subsequent scholars. Waldo Shumway in 1932, that's over 40 years ago, in his article called The Recapitulation Theory, published in Quarterly Review of Biology, Volume 7, March of 1932, on page 98, made the following statement in referring to this, the results of experimental biology and this recapitulation theory, says that it seems to demand that the hypothesis be abandoned. He goes on to say that those of us who were reared in the phylogenetic tradition, that is the evolutionary tradition, may see it go with a sigh of regret. Those of us charged with the responsibility of explaining the law of evolution to our classes will miss a familiar maxim, easily learned and a convenient skeleton on which to hang the discrete data of embryology. But there can be no excuse for continuing to impress plastic minds by means of discredited generalizations," unquote. And we could cite much more evidence from embryologists themselves as to the nature of this theory. It has become thoroughly discredited by embryologists who are familiar with the data from embryology. But those biologists and evolutionists and others who are not embryologists, who are not knowledgeable in this area, continue to perpetuate the error that was given to us by Haeckel and Darwin and others. Now, just to give you some of the idea of the contradictions involved, let's take the human embryo, for example. It is said that the human embryo has gill slits. One of the most astounding things I ever heard in my life was at the National Association of Biology Teachers Convention in 1972. By the way, that convention was set up specifically for beating down the creationists. From the word go until the convention was over with, this was the whole purpose of the convention, to discredit the creationists. But I had been aware of the theme of the convention and had written to the program chairman and suggested, since the theme that year was biology and evolution, they should certainly hear from some creationists, suggested they give us a half a day symposium. They agreed to give us a couple of hours. So Dr. John Moore and I addressed the entire convention. And so we had an opportunity to present the case for creation. Dr. Dobzhansky led off on Monday morning. And from the beginning, he was blasting away at the creationists and so forth and giving all this evidence for evolution, including evidence from embryology. And he stated that the human embryo had gill slits. And if evolution were true, why in the world then did God place gill slits in the human embryo if evolution weren't true? Well, I couldn't believe my ears. A man of that stature, a geneticist who ought to know better, not only is the theory discredited, but genetically it would be impossible anyhow. The human embryo does not have gill slits. There are a series of bars and grooves in the neck region of the embryos, including the fish. Now, in the fish, structures in that area develop into the gill slits. It opens and forms a slit into the throat and develops into the respiratory structures of the fish, in other words, the gills. Now, in the human and other mammals, of course, and in reptiles and birds, There are a series of bars and grooves in the neck region, which has a superficial resemblance to the same thing in the fishes. But they do not open into the throat, so they are never slits. They do not develop into respiratory tissue, so they are never gills. Now, if they are neither slits nor gills, then how in the world can they be gill slits? There's simply a superficial resemblance here. It has nothing to do with gill slits, respiration, or anything else of this kind. This area in the human embryo, for example, develops into the lower jaw, the middle ear, certain glands, and so forth. Completely and totally different than anything seen in the fish. The human embryo does not have gill slits at any stage in its development. Furthermore, in the human, the tongue develops before the teeth. That's out of order. The brain before the nerve cords. The heart before the blood vessels. All out of order. The human embryo, the heart in the human embryo does not go from one chamber to two chambers to three to four, if it recapitulates. But it starts out as a two-chambered heart, which fuses to a single chamber, which develops directly to four. So the order in the human is two to one to four. And there is some data supposedly from the kidney, which supposedly recapitulates. But you read the material by Romer, for example, who says that the kidney is supposed to show something about evolution, but he denies that it does. So you follow all of this very carefully. Get into the literature. See what the experts have to say, and you find that this theory is totally discredited. It has no intellectual content in the first place. If, supposing that our ancestors were fishes at one time, and they had all this set of genes that made them fishes, and then they evolve, and that means the genes change, and they become genes that makes it an amphibian. So many, many genes have changed now, and it's an amphibian. Then the amphibians evolve, so many, many, many genes change, so that it becomes a reptile. And then the evolution changes, or continues, so many, many more genes change to make a mammal out of the reptile, and then a primate, and then man. You see, you've had all these genes disappear or become other genes. Now, let me ask you a question. How in the world would a human embryo remember that 300 million years or so ago he was a fish and looked like a fish and lay down gill slits and all that sort of nonsense? Why, it's just absolutely ridiculous. The whole idea is absurd from the very beginning. And the data very definitely contradicts recapitulation. Plants don't recapitulate. Absolutely, there's no doubt about it. Animals don't recapitulate. There are so many contradictions, so many problems, that it has been abandoned by knowledgeable evolutionists, knowledgeable embryologists. The theory should be read out of the literature, but it'll be around for many, many years yet to come. Now about this subject of vestigial organs. A vestigial organ now is defined as an organ which now is completely useless. Completely useless, has no function whatsoever. It's merely a vestige of an organ which at one time was functional in our ancestors. If there is any structure or organ that has a function in any way at any stage during the development or the lifespan of the organism, it is not vestigial. Well, back about 100 years ago, one scientist listed about 180 organs and structures in the human that was vestigial. These structures included the thymus gland, the pineal gland, the pituitary gland, many other glands, included the coccyx or tailbone, the appendix, tonsils, and many other structures and organs. Well, during the past 100 years, medical and scientific research has eliminated practically every one of those organs as possibly being vestigial. The list has shrunk practically to zero. And if there are any remaining at all, no doubt that future medical research will eliminate these very few, if there are any remaining at all. For example, we know, of course, that the pituitary gland is the master gland of the body. The pineal gland is an extremely important gland. The thyroid gland, of course, very intimately involved in the defense mechanisms of the body. So all these glands are very, very useful. None of them are vestigial. What about the tonsils? When I was a kid, this was considered just to be an old vestigial organ, had no function, just a focus of infection. So if one of the kids had tonsillitis, you'd take all of them. You'd take 4 or 5 of your kids into the hospital one time and get rid of all these old vestigial organs and eliminate any possible future problems. Well, in many cases, no doubt that was disastrous for the child, because it has been demonstrated and proven that the tonsil is an important disease-fighting organ. It protects the child against bulbar polio and many other diseases. Very important, particularly in the juvenile. And removing the appendix, the tonsils, then reduces that individual's resistance to disease. Now, sometimes, because of repeated tonsillitis, it's better to get rid of the tonsils. My younger son had repeated cases of tonsillitis. He'd have several during the winter. He was better off without the tonsils. If you get gangrene in your left arm, it's better that they amputate and you get rid of your left arm, but it's certainly not vestigial. I could do without my right leg. I could do without, some claim I could be better off without my head. But none of these structures are vestigial. They're very important. We can do without them, but they are very importantly functional. The same is true of the appendix. The appendix is an important disease-fighting organ. It elaborates antibodies and things of that kind. Furthermore, it has been shown that the appendix helps to generate blood in the unborn. And also, it aids in recovery from radiation damage. The appendix is an important organ. It is not vestigial. It is not something inherited from the rabbit or something like that. So, you know, in the rabbit, the appendix or the corresponding structure is, participate and digest and things like that, very large, which it does not in the human. And supposedly we have inherited this appendix from the rabbit. It's now no longer functional, you see, in digestion, and so it's just a vestige. Well, there's a lot of problems with that. In the first place, as I pointed out, the appendix is a very important disease-fighting organ. It's not vestigial. Furthermore, there are many primates that do not have an appendix. And we supposedly have evolved, you see, from apes or monkeys or something related to these. And if they don't have it, we shouldn't have it, but we do have it. There are very few primates that do have an appendix. And there are many other animals that do not have an appendix that supposedly are between man and the rabbit. And so the data does not fit at all. Now, there are other organs. The coccyx, or tailbone, that's just supposed to be a vestige of a tail. Well, in the first place, apes don't have tails. Many monkeys don't have tails. And so it's strange that we have this vestige of a tail when our ancestors did not even have tails. Furthermore, the coccyx is not vestigial. It is not useless. The coccyx is a very important structure. You can't sit comfortably without the coccyx. You've had to have the coccyx removed because of cancer or something like that. You'll find that's very uncomfortable. Furthermore, important pelvic muscles are anchored to the coccyx, the muscles involved in parturition or childbearing, muscles involved in elimination. Muscles of this kind are anchored to the coccyx, so it's a very important functional organ. Furthermore, as someone has said, the spinal column had to be terminated somehow. Do you have a better idea? It's a very useful way for terminating the spinal column, if for nothing else. No, it is not a vestigial organ. The plica semilunaris is the folded tissue in the corner of the eye, supposed to be a vestigial remain of the nictitating membrane, or the third eyelid, as it is known in some animals. Birds have it. Some reptiles have this membrane. And plica semilunaris then is supposed to be a vestigial remain of that. Actually, the plica semilunaris in man is very, very functional and important. It sweeps the eye of foreign matter, and it also secretes a fatty substance, which helps to surround this material and minimize the discomfort to the eye. That's why you wake up in the morning and you find this material in the corner of the eye. That's material, the fatty substance elaborated by the plica semilunaris. So it is certainly not vestigial. It's extremely functional. And so it goes. Some have said that the muscles, you know, some people can train their muscles to wiggle their ears. My oldest brother could do that. And oh, that's just the vestigial remains of the muscles involved, you know, making the ears stand up straight and dogs and things like that. Well, actually, these muscles are the facial muscles, which have other functions, of course, in the facial expressions and so forth. They also provide the bed necessary to bring the blood vessels to the ear. And so they have function. They're not vestigial. And the muscles, the erectile muscles involved in raising the goosebumps, you know, that's supposed to be vestigial remains of muscles involved in the erection hair, you know, in the animals, you know, dogs and cats and so forth. Well, the goosebump reaction man, of course, is involved in the temperature regulation. And so none of these are vestigial. The so-called pelvic bones in the whale is supposed to be vestigial remains of when he was a land animal. Well, I pointed out earlier there are no transitional forms from any land mammal to the whale, showing a transition from this land mammal to the whale. Absolutely no transitional forms whatsoever. Furthermore, those pelvic bones are functional. The muscles, again, involved in parturition, bearing the young, and in elimination are anchored to the pelvic bones. So they are functional. And so it goes. Every one of these structures that you can find, you'll find a function for them. Now, finally, I suppose we could throw this in. Even if these were truly vestigial, it's the disappearance of a structure and not the origin of a structure. That brings up another thought. If evolution is true, and of course it would still be occurring today, no reason why it wouldn't be occurring today, just as rapidly, as fast as ever, the total number of mutations possible are almost infinite in number, and combinations of these mutations are infinite in number. Surely, the number of mutations that could have occurred since, say, 3 or 4 billion years ago, let's say 3 billion years, they assume life arose about 3 billion years ago, the number of mutations that have actually occurred in that time are infinitesimal in comparison to the total number possible, including the combinations involved. And so evolution should not be dead. It should be going on as rapidly as ever today. So we should find not only the vestigial organs, but nascent organs, or new structures coming into being. We should find many, many transitional forms among individuals, populations today. But there's, I don't know of a single case that evolutionists can point to as an example of a transitional form that is now living and on its way to being something else. One biologist asked Dr. Dobzhansky many years ago for examples of this kind. And he said that he could not point to an example, but we have to go to the fossil record to find evidence for transitional forms. So the scientist made a thorough search of the fossil record. And he found the paleontologist pointing out the fact that the transitional forms are systematically absent in the fossil record as well. So we find them neither in the past nor in the present. So the evidence for evolution from vestigial organs, there's just no evidence there. Now we want to consider this matter of homology. A homologous structure is simply defined as structures found in different organisms which are similar in their structure. That doesn't have to say anything about function. For example, the four limbs in wings and the four limbs in other animals are homologous because they have bones in them that are similar in their structure. Now their function is entirely different. We can't fly with our four limbs, but the birds can. But nevertheless, our four limbs are said to be homologous to those in birds because of their similar structure. And our four limbs are supposed to be, or said to be, homologous to the four limbs of reptiles and amphibians and so forth because of the similarity in their structure. Now, the man who invented or coined this term homology and homologous structures was Richard Owen, Dr. Richard Owen, anatomist, great scientist, and he was a spatial creationist. He saw no evolutionary significance whatsoever in the fact that there are similar structures in different animals. Now, of course, the evolutionists do. They said that homologous structures exist because they have been inherited from a common ancestor. And so, we have assumed some common ancestor which evolved and gave rise to other animals. Now, if these animals possess these similar structures, they possess these similar structures because they have inherited them from the common ancestor. Very logical, isn't it? We'd have to admit that's a very plausible suggestion. But as time proceeded, many, many problems were encountered with this explanation. First of all, there are many animals which have similar structures, homologous structures, but the common ancestor doesn't possess the homologous structure. Well, I think everybody, evolutionist, creationist, or otherwise, would have to concede that in this case, the presence or possession of those homologous structures proves absolutely nothing. They admit the common ancestor, supposed common ancestor, did not have the homologous structure. They were not inherited from a common ancestor. Therefore, the possession of these homologous structures can prove nothing in any case. No case can it prove anything. Now, of course, they still believe where the assumed common ancestor does possess these homologous structures, that the animals that inherited or that possess these homologous structures possess them because they inherited from a common ancestor. But as we will see shortly, the data does not fit that interpretation. But what do they call this, where the animals supposedly related have homologous structures, but the assumed common ancestor does not? In that case, they call this parallel evolution. Supposedly, you had the common ancestor, which diverged then to give rise to these two other creatures. And then later, independently, these two animals evolved that similar structure independently of one another. Where the common ancestor supposedly was recent, they call that parallel evolution. Now, in other cases, where animals possess similar structures, called homologous structures, where the common ancestor was very remote in time, they call that convergent evolution. Sometimes the terms are confused. Sometimes they call parallel evolution convergent evolution. But generally, this is the interpretation given. Now, take, for example, the squid and vertebrates. Their eyes are similar. They have eyes. And there are many similarities. But when you trace back to the assumed common ancestor, you've got to go way, way, way back. Hundreds of millions of years ago, according to evolutionary interpretation. And the common ancestor didn't have any eyes. So obviously the squid and vertebrates evolved their eyes independently. So this is called convergent evolution. As some evolutionists have pointed out, it's difficult enough to imagine how an incredibly complex structure like the eye could have evolved in the first place by random mutation, let alone to imagine how it may have happened two or three times independently by random accidental chance mutation. This is absolutely incredible to imagine how any structure like the eye, which could not be really be functional, to have survival value until it had the proper structures, it had the lens, cornea, and the nerve cords. The human eye has 10 million nerve cords to each eye. And of course, you must have a brain that has the ability to sort out all this information. We could have a perfect eye and have all these nerve cords running somewhere, but if you don't have the massive communication network known as the brain, the computer that can take all this information and convert it into an image, we wouldn't see anything. That brain is absolutely, put a bullet in your brain. If you're still breathing, you're not going to see anything. You don't have anything that those impulses are, you're still getting the image into the eye. And the nerve impulses are still going down to the brain, but you're not seeing anything. You've destroyed your computer, you see. You've got to have all this, and it's got to be coordinated. Now imagine all that just happening accidentally. It just so happened. Purely accidentally. The nerve cords got generated, and the cornea, and the lens, and the rods, and cones, and all that just accidentally got generated somehow, and the brain just accidentally somehow got all this incredible machinery generated so it could interpret what it was seeing, so to speak. That's absolutely incredible. But imagine that happening several times. Well, that's what they are forced to postulate in this parallel evolution and convergent evolution. As a matter of fact, they're saying that most of these homologous structures are due to convergent evolution or parallel evolution. Furthermore, not only are they forced to postulate that certain individual structures have evolved independently, but suites of major structures have evolved independently. Now, what do I mean by a suite? Well, for example, and I'm not saying this would represent a precise case, but take the ears, the ability to hear, the ability to see, and the ability to smell. There's certainly a suite of major structures. Each one is a major structure. And the combination is a suite, S-U-I-T-E. Well, in many cases, there are animals that possess suites of major structures that are homologous, that are similar, but the common ancestor possesses none of these. So these animals, then, according to the theory of evolution, independently, not only had to evolve certain structures, major structures, independently, by random chance, accidental processes, but had to evolve combinations of these major structures. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. The whole idea seems to defy any rational explanation. As a matter of fact, when you look hard at the data, it doesn't. I have with me an Oxford biology reader. By the way, I'd recommend that you write to the Oxford Biology Press or to some biological supply house and ask them to send you a list of these Oxford biology readers. I obtained mine from the Carolina Biological Supply, down in Burlington, North Carolina. But there's some real gems among these Oxford biology readers, and here's the best of all. It's by Sir Gavin De Vere, the British biologist and evolutionist. He is a most rabid evolutionist. The title of this Oxford biology reader is Homology an unsolved problem. Homology, an unsolved problem. Now, let me remind you that in times past, the evolutionist says we have a very logical, a very reasonable explanation for the possession of homologous structures. They are possessed because they have been inherited from a common ancestor. That's the explanation. Sir Gavin is forced to admit the data doesn't fit that explanation. Let me give you some of the problems. Well, I already mentioned some of them, where the common ancestor did not possess the so-called homologous structure, requiring so-called independent or convergent evolution. But there are even more serious objections to that. First of all, in following the embryological development, the embryologist will number the trunk segments, and he can relate one trunk segment to another animal by the development. What proceeds from that trunk segment? What organs? What structures? What nerves? What blood vessels? And they have found that in the newt, which is an amphibian, that the forelimbs develop from trunk segments 2 to 5. That's the forelimb developed from these trunk segments. All right, now, let's take the lizard, which is a reptile. Now, it has forelimbs. Now, if the forelimbs in the reptile are homologous to the forelimbs in the newt, you would expect, then, the forelimbs to develop from trunk segments 2 to 5. But as a matter of fact, in the lizard, they develop from trunk segments 6 to 9. Not trunk segments 2 to 5, and in man, they develop from trunk segments 13 to 18. Rather strange, isn't it? It really is rather unexpected. Now, that tells us this idea of evolution, there are homologous structures are due to inherited from a common ancestor, really doesn't fit the data. What Sir Gavin suggests, well, there was this whole thing just moved down somewhere like this, and then this just the whole thing just moved down the trunk. He makes this suggestion that there's an even worse problem with the data than this. Now, according to evolutionists, homologous structures are possessed because of inheritance from a common ancestor. That's where at least where the common ancestor possesses the homologous structure. Now, that means that common ancestor had a certain set of genetic factors, genes, which gave rise to this particular structure. These genes were inherited by the evolutionary offspring. Absolutely. The only way you can explain this evolution, possession of homologous structures, where the common ancestor possessed the homologous structure. But when you go back to the gene level, you cannot trace these homologous structures back to identical genes. You don't come back to the same gene at all. You see, you've got to do that. If you had a complex of genes, let's say gene A, B, C, D, E, F, which gave rise, let's say, to an arm. Well, these genes are passed on to evolutionary offspring on down the line, and so we have homologous structure. Now, there's been some modification of the genes because our forelimbs are not identical to those of the reptiles and the amphibians, but very similar. So many genes would be possessed in common. But when you trace the homologous structures back to the genes, you do not come back to identical genes. Listen to what Sir Gavin has to say. He says, it is now clear that the pride with which it was assumed that the inheritance of homologous structures from a common ancestor explained homology was misplaced. What's he saying? Let me reword that. What he's saying is this. We had a lot of pride in the fact that we could explain homologous structures by the fact that they're inherited from a common ancestor. We had a lot of pride. We assumed we could do that. That was the explanation. But he says the pride was misplaced. For such inheritance cannot be ascribed to identity of genes. The attempt to find homologous genes, except in closely related species, has been given up as hopeless. And so it goes. You can't trace homologous structures back to identical genes. You don't trace them back to the same trunk segment. Often the common ancestor doesn't even possess these homologous structures. The data doesn't fit at all. It contradicts the data. The data contradict. The real serious contradiction is here. When you trace this back to the gene level, you don't come back to the same gene. Now that just absolutely throws out this whole idea of homologous structures being possessed because of inheritance from a common ancestor. The data doesn't fit evolution. Well, what about the creationist explanation? How does the creationist explain homology? Embryological development and so forth. Well, you see, God, the creator, is a master planner with a master plan. Stated simply, God is a good engineer. And when you go to school, an engineering school, you learn certain good engineering principles. How to build bridges. Generally, engineers use those principles. Once in a while, they miss and a bridge falls into the bay or something like that. But generally, they do a pretty good job because they have applied good, sound engineering principles. Now, all bridges look alike, don't they? They look very much alike. So bridges are similar because the engineer has used the same good, sound engineering principles in designing bridges. Now, there are differences because of local conditions. The length of the span, the depth of the water, the wind stress, the load stress, and so forth. Well, all of the particular conditions, so the engineer will vary his design to meet the local conditions. Now, the same is true in structures that we possess. God had a problem creating a four-legged amphibian. He used good sound engineering principles in the design of those structures, good structural principles. Now, when God went to design a four-legged reptile, would he not use the same good sound engineering principles? Or a four-legged mammal? Of course he would. Would we not expect then that the structures in a four-legged reptile, four-legged mammal, four-legged amphibian to be quite similar? Of course we would expect this similarity. Same is true in other structures, the teeth and so forth. We'd expect teeth to be similar and yet different because of the different diets that the animals were expected to use. Same is true of our biochemistry. Why would we expect God to come up with an entirely new biochemical system for every species that he created? Well, that would be very poor economics. If you've got a solution, why not stick with it? The fact is, it is based upon good, sound biological, biochemical principles. Of course you'd use it. Now, for example, converting sugar to carbon dioxide and water. Many animals do this. We do it. Birds do it. Reptiles do it. Amphibians do it. Fishes do it. Converting sugar to carbon dioxide and water. Now, we find that there is a very, very involved process. Now, you can convert sugar to carbon dioxide and water very easily. Just touch a match to it, and it'll burn. And it goes directly to carbon dioxide and water. We don't do it that way. We require a very long, involved process because we must derive the chemical energy. We must trap the chemical energy released by this process, convert it into high-energy chemical compounds, which then can be used later in our metabolic activity. So there are many steps involved in this, involving many intermediates and many enzymes. Many, many, many steps are involved. Start out with the glucose, of course, and then which is split into two other compounds, and an enzyme is involved in this. Well, first you have to phosphorylate it. You have glucose 1-phosphate and glucose 6-phosphate and so forth and so on and all this. And then you split and you get different compounds, different phosphate groups here and there. And there's many, many steps. And every once in a while, the energy released is placed in the form of a high energy bond in ATP. But all this is said and done, then you've got a lot of energy derived from this process. Well, we find that the process is very similar in different animals. That process found in man is similar in other animals. The evolutionist says, aha, see, evidence for evolution. Here are the same process, same enzymes involved. It shows that we all came from a common ancestor. But you see, the creation model demands the same thing. And we'd expect the same thing. We wouldn't expect God to, if he's got 100 different species, to have 100 different ways of converting sugar to carbon dioxide and water. That wouldn't make sense. Good sound principles are used in every case. And so we'd expect these similarities. Furthermore, we would expect our biochemistry to be more similar to that of a chimpanzee than we would a snake. We are more similar to chimpanzees than we are snakes. If you don't believe that, take a big mirror with you when you go to the zoo next time and look at a chimpanzee, look at yourself, and then look at a snake, and you'll see that you are more similar to the chimpanzee. And if the structures are a reflection of the biochemistry, I think we certainly expect that, then we'd expect the similarities to be more similar in these cases. Again, the evolutionist takes this as evidence that we are more closely related to chimpanzees than we are to other animals. I think that's logical. I would certainly see it from his point of view that he would make this assumption. It's a logical assumption. The problem with this is that you begin to run into contradictions again, just as we have in morphology. We find that in the biochemistry. For example, some of the insulins in whales that are very closely related are different, while the insulins between whales that are not so closely related are identical. And I think it's the insulin in the case of the guinea pig. It's 14 differences between the insulin of guinea pig and that of the of man. But there are also 14 differences between the insulin of guinea pig and a fellow rodent, the rat. But the rat, of course, and the guinea pig are supposed to be much more closely related than man is to the guinea pig. And we find more and more of this kind of contradictory data is coming forth. Now, evolution is mechanistic, naturalistic, must be consistent. We would not demand these same consistencies. God were the creator. Of course, the evolutionists could rationalize it the same way. There are some reasons for this. We just don't know. And I would have to I'd have to concede that he would have that option. But in any case, I think what we're going to find that there are so many, many inconsistencies here as time goes on. Now, furthermore, when you try to construct a phylogeny based upon chemicals, you find you've got to make a choice. Now, you have all these different compounds. You may have compounds A to Z, and you find as you compare these compounds among these animals that in some cases they're similar, in some cases they aren't. Well, now you've got to decide which one of these compounds are important as far as reconstructed phylogeny. Which ones are you going to ignore and which ones are you going to assume that are important? Well, biochemist A, he looks over A to Z and he says, well, compounds A, F, Z, I, K, and he likes it. These are the important ones. So I'm going to base my phylogeny on these compounds. And then he gets a certain phylogeny. Another biochemist looks at these and says, well, he selects a different compound. He says, well, these aren't important, but these are. And he comes up with a different set of compounds, which he feels are important. You come up with a different phylogeny. Because there are differences. The data is not totally, is not consistent, you see. Well, and then finally, the biochemist compares his phylogeny to those of the paleontologist, and he finds out he has a different phylogeny. Who's right, the paleontologist or the biochemist? The biochemist insists that his is correct. The paleontologist is not about to give up on his phylogeny and his based on morphology and so forth in many cases. So you have these contradictions. What I'm trying to say is that that is not consistent, as it should be, if these structures, homologous structures, are due to evolution. So I think as we look over all of this data, we find that it is consistent, by the way, with the creationist interpretation. Very consistent. Generally, it is consistent with an evolutionary interpretation, but there are growing inconsistencies. And certainly in this case, where you try to relate the data to the theory, it doesn't fit at all. It does not fit. There are these very important critical contradictions. You see, generally it does fit. We do have forelimbs that are similar to the forelimbs of reptiles and amphibians. That's true. That fits this evolutionary interpretation. Go look at the embryological data, and it doesn't fit. Look at the data from the genes. It does not fit. Absolutely does not fit. It's got to fit, but it does not. Another thing about this data from the embryos and the forelimbs, there's something else that proves. It proves that embryos don't recapitulate embryos. You see, one of the modern modifications, embryological recapitulation idea, is that, well, the embryo doesn't recapitulate its adult ancestors. That's what Haeckel used to claim and Darwin. But the human embryo recapitulates the embryo stages of its evolutionary development. In other words, the human embryo looks like an embryo of a fish, an embryo of a amphibian, an embryo of an ape, and so forth and so on. That's the modified. They're trying to salvage something out of this, you see. Well, the data that that Sir Gavin here has described shows that embryos don't recapitulate embryos. If embryos were recapitulating, then of course, if forelimbs in the amphibian come from trunk segments 2 to 5, then if the reptile embryo is recapitulating, then those forelimbs ought to come from trunk segments 2 to 5. But they don't. They come from trunk segments 3 to 6. Quite obviously, the human embryo is not recapitulating because the forelimbs don't start out from trunk segments 2 to 5 and then shift down to trunk segments 3 to 6 and then shift down to 13 to 18. It doesn't do that at all. It develops directly from trunk segments 13 to 18. Quite obviously, is it not? The human embryo is not recapitulating. What do embryos do? Embryos do precisely what is necessary to live, to exist while they are developing. And this whole mode of development of the embryo is designed for one thing. It must start out as a single cell, of course. How else does it start out? It begins as a single fertilized cell. It has to start out with a single cell. That doesn't mean we're related to bacteria or anything like that. You have to start out with a single cell. And what's the next step? It's got to develop into a multicellular structure, doesn't it? How else can it do? It has to go to multicellular. And it goes through these stages, which are required for its development. At all times, it must function. As the kidney comes into existence, as the heart and so forth, it is structured in just that way, which just allows it to function as it develops. It has nothing to do with any evolutionary history. At any time, a qualified embryologist could look at a human embryo and tell you it's a human embryo. He wouldn't confuse it with that of a dog or that of a fish. If he couldn't tell it's a human embryo, he's no embryologist. Someone has said, if you're going to have 10 trains go from some city to 10 different cities scattered throughout the United States, you don't start them out on 10 different tracks. They all start out on the same track. If you're going to leave Kansas City, they all start out on the same track, don't they? But the further they get from the station, the more they diverge into other track systems. And finally, they reach 10 different cities scattered throughout the United States. That's the way the embryo starts. Starts as one cell, goes to multicellular, and so forth and so on, simply required by the development of the embryo. It has nothing to do with any evolution. And so we see that the so-called evidence for evolution from embryology has been thoroughly discredited. Matter of fact, it contradicts the idea. The evidence from homology, generally, we see in many respects, supports both the creation model and the evolution model. But when it gets down to some of the very critical aspects of the evidence, we find that the evidence definitely contradicts evolutionary theory. Not only does not support it, but it contradicts it. And the evidence from vestigial organs, we find that these organs are not vestigial at all. But they are functional, therefore not vestigial. And we find no evidence for nosset organism coming into being. So we see then that all this evidence taken as a whole does support the concept of creation. Contradicts in many important aspects the evidence for evolution. Okay. Grade B miracle, as Dr. Morris would call it. I finished ahead of time this morning. Yes, ma'am.
In the Bible, God put a curse on the snake. Is it just assumed that the snake at one time was walking?
Well, you see, I don't know. Now, firstly, we can't say it was a snake. It was a serpent. Well, we say a serpent is a snake. We cannot say. Now, what it seems to me that Satan had possessed this creature. And in that case, it might have been able to do things which ordinarily a serpent couldn't do. It must have walked or something, because the Bible says that God cursed it, and then on it should crawl on its belly, or it seems to indicate that it was then subsequently a snake or serpent of some kind, which had been different in structure. Now, God changed it quite definitely, and it seems to me probably that Satan possessed this animal. Yes.
Don't really find anything on a snake today that looks like there might have been a place at one time where
there might have been a what?
There's no place on a snake today. I've heard some people say that it looks like there at one time there might have been
It has spurs. Some snakes have spurs, which are supposed to be vestigial remains of the pelvic bone. The spurs, of course, in the snake are not vestigial, in that they are functional. They do have function. They do help the animal, of course, to cleave to the ground and something like that. A vestigial organ has to be something that has no function whatsoever. These spurs certainly do have a function.
And none of those are found on the snake.
That's right.
Yes.
Can you discuss the evolutionist claim regarding chemical balance called between seawater and blood?
Yes. The question is about discussing the evolutionary claim that there is a balance between the cellular material, cytoplasmic material, and seawater, which then proves that we evolved from the sea. Now, let me tell you, first of all, what makes that claim ridiculous. Life supposedly evolved 3 billion years ago, right? So, if there's some relationship between the salt content of the seawater and that found in ourselves, which are supposed to prove anything about evolution, then the salt content in our cells would be similar to that 3 billion years ago, not the present sea content. What has happened in 3 billion years? Chemicals, salts of all kinds, have poured out into the sea for 3 billion years, according to evolution theory. You see, uranium, sodium chloride, all kinds of salts are continually eroded and carried into the sea. You can calculate the quantity of potassium and sodium salts and uranium salts and everything else are being carried into the sea. One thing is certain, the present salt ratios and content cannot be similar today what it was 3 billion years ago. If there was a primordial ocean 3 billion years ago, it's got to have drastic alterations. These salts are going into the ocean at different ratios, different quantity. The ratios would have changed drastically since in that last 3 billion years. And if life did evolve from the sea 3 billion years ago, the salt ratios in our cells should not be similar. Should be different. And furthermore, if you've had all this evolution since life evolved, surely that evolution would have changed the salt ratios. How would it be possible to have all this evolution from a little microorganism all the way to man and have no change in his salt ratio? Isn't that remarkable? All that evolutionary change took place and our salt ratio is the same. Why, this whole idea is just absolutely totally devoid of any intellectual content. These people who make these things, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it just goes to show, and Dr. Morris and I and others in this have continually impressed by the shallow thinking of evolution. If they had a good case, they would not have to resort to this shallow thinking, stupid arguments, and everything else that they do. And believe me, we have debated all over the world, United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, places like that. We've come up against every argument, and we know their thinking. And I'm telling you, they generally do a very lousy job, and their faulty thinking, their shallow thinking. Listen, if they had a good case, they would nail us to the wall. And they would have arguments that were sound, intellectually sound, that were in accordance with the data, that were reasonable. And the more and more we hear their arguments, the less respect we have for their argument. It's just absolutely terrible. Yes.
Okay. The gentleman in the blue shirt. Then we'll come back to the gentleman in the yellow shirt. Yes.
Can you discuss Dr. Heckel's alleged dishonesty in reporting the findings of his original research?
Yes, I should have mentioned that. Ernst Haeckel, it was demonstrated that he had falsified his data. He had taken certain woodcuts and had shortened the tail of the dog embryo and lengthened the tail in a human embryo to make them more similar. He had showed a picture of four different eggs of different creatures. Said, look how identical they are. They were identical, all right. He just repeated the picture of the same egg four times. Of course they were identical. He showed the same picture four different times. Now, it was proven that Haeckel had falsified his data. Bill Rush, Wilbert Rush, in the Creation Research Society Journal some years ago, very wonderfully documented the fact that Ernst Haeckel had falsified his data. The only University had some investigation on this and proven that he had falsified his data. And Haeckel was the one who made in a statement, one of his books, that this conflict between creation and evolution was a conflict between, on one side, intellectual development, light, intelligence, reasonableness, all of that, versus the church hierarchy, darkness, ignorance, and so forth and so on. He contrasted the evolution-creation conflict in these terms, while he himself was guilty of deliberately falsifying his data to support his theory. Now, yes.
Were the animals that
The question is, do some of the animals have to undergo genetic and structural changes when they were converted from plant eaters to meat eaters? Now, I do not know, but I suspect there was considerable genetic engineering at that time. Now, first of all, we know that there was genetic engineering at the time of the fall of man, because God said, let thorns and thistles come forth. Let man now earn his bread by the sweat of his brow, and so forth. And the woman's conception would be multiplied and in pain and so forth. There were changes, genetic changes, that occurred at that time. The Bible mentions some. How many others were there? We do not know. I'm convinced there were no such things, certainly, as pathogenic organisms, viruses, parasites, and things of that kind. So there were other genetic changes. Now, were genetic changes brought about to modify animals so that they became carnivorous, where before they were herbivorous? We cannot be certain. It is certainly possible that animals were able to adapt to a carnivorous way of life while others were not, although they may have all been herbivorous. But it is difficult to understand, if all animals were herbivorous, why animals had teeth that, you know, seemed to be remarkably adapted for tearing flesh and claws and so forth. Furthermore, as we mentioned yesterday, these marvelous defense mechanisms, armor, and these spikes that we find on dinosaurs, and the club on the tail of the Ankylosaurus. Ankylosaurus is an armored dinosaur, and out of the tail he has a big, huge, bony knob, which makes a nice war club. And the bombardier beetle. And bombardier beetle, that's a remarkable little thing. The bombardier beetle has a remarkable defense mechanism. When an enemy approaches, the bombardier beetle, some beetle eater of some kind comes up and ready to snap his jaws on the beetle, an explosion takes place right in the face of his enemy, and noxious gases pour out of twin combustion tubes at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that's a remarkable defense mechanism. And if there weren't any beetle eaters, why did he need the defense mechanism? Well, either God must have done some genetic engineering at that time, or else there was death among animals, but not man. Now, I don't want to get into really serious theological difficulties. If that's theologically wrong, I will not subscribe to it, I assure you that. But now, a German chemist undertook an investigation of the bombardier beetle. He found that the bombardier beetle has twin storage chambers, twin combustion tubes. And in those storage chambers, he stores a mixture of hydrogen peroxide and hydrogen quinone. I think it's 23% hydrogen peroxide and 10% hydroquinone. Now, this is an explosive reaction mixture. And if you and I went in the laboratory and mixed these two chemicals, it'd explode in our faces. But the bombardier beetle adds an inhibitor, which prevents the explosion. And then when an enemy approaches him, he squirts this solution into the twin combustion tubes, and just at the right moment, he adds an anti-inhibitor, and boom, it explodes in the face of his enemy. Well, now let's try to imagine how the bombardier beetle worked this out by evolution. Well, let's think about that. Let us assume that millions of years ago, there was this little beetle. Let's call him Beetle Bailey. Shall we call him Beetle Bailey? And one day his mom and dad gave him a chemistry set, maybe for his birthday. And so he's down in his basement laboratory, and he was experimenting. One day he mixed a solution of hydrogen quinone and hydrogen peroxide. Blew him up and scattered him all around the walls of the laboratory. That was the end of Beetle Bailey. Well, for then hundreds of generations, thousand generations, maybe several tens of thousands of years, little beetles were mixing up hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinones and blowing themselves up. Boom, 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 boom. For many thousands of generations. Now, then for some strange reason, one of them invented the inhibitor. Now, you see, he didn't need the inhibitor until he mixed up the chemicals. When he mixed up the chemicals, he blew himself up. So he couldn't pass the information down to his offspring, that you just don't do that because he didn't have any offspring. So there's no way to, you know, pass down this information. So he just keeps blowing himself up. And then for some strange, unusual reason, he invents the inhibitor. Isn't that a tremendous evolutionary success, triumph? No, not quite. Because now he just got the two chemicals of the inhibitor and he stores it. He's got to have a storage chamber, and I don't know how that came about, but he's got it and he mixes it up. But what does it do? It doesn't do anything, does it? Just sits there and corrodes his innards. I mean, it's not going to do it. And for thousands of more generations then, these beetles are mixing up these chemicals, adding an inhibitor and corroding their innards, and all this goes on for thousands of generations. But then, now he didn't need the anti-inhibitor until he had the inhibitor, and he didn't need the inhibitor until he had the chemicals. But then, for some strange reasons, one of them invented the anti-inhibitor. Tremendous evolutionary triumph. No, completely fatal. You see, all he got is the storage chambers, he mixed up the chemicals, adds the inhibitor, and then the anti-inhibitor blew him. Boom. He's gone again. So boom, boom, boom. Thousands of generations, he blows himself up. And he's got to have the combustion chambers. Well, he doesn't need the combustion chambers until he's got the two chemicals, the inhibitor, anti-inhibitor. So why would he ever invent a combustion chambers? Well, somehow, for some reason, it finally came about. Now, here we are, all set. We've got the two chemicals, we've got the storage chambers, we've got the inhibitor, we've got the anti-inhibitor, and we've got the combustion chamber. We're all set. No, not quite. You see, he's got to have everything timed right. He's got to have the right communication network. Can you imagine how embarrassing it would be if he's got that chemical and he squirts it into the combustion chamber and his friend comes up and pats him on the back and says, "Hi, Joe, how are you?" Boom! Goes off in the face of his friend. No, he's got to know when to send the signal. He's got to have the communication network. He's got to know when he's threatened. And he's got to have everything complete. He's got to have the chemicals, the inhibitor, the storage chambers. By the way, the storage chamber had to be, you know, proper for storing those kind of chemicals. And the combustion chamber, well, it had to be, I don't know, glass lined or ceramic lined or something. It's got to stand at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. This little tender tissue won't do that. We don't have any organs like that. And so he's got to have all of that complete. He's in the communications network. By the way, I'm going to suggest, I'm writing a book on dinosaurs. The first edition is going to be for children. I'm sure most people will find it interesting for adults anyhow. But all about dinosaurs, how they came about and why, and all the different kinds of dinosaurs and why they became extinct. And then I'm going to suggest maybe there really were dragons. You know, the Bible describes something that sounds very much like a dragon. The Leviathan in Job chapter 41, isn't it? In chapter 40, describes the behemoth, sounds like a dinosaur. And in Leviathan, sounds like a dragon. What ever heard, you know, the ridiculous idea of a dragon? Well, there are legends, many legends about dragons. Maybe there really were things like this in times past. If a little old beetle, about that long, about a half an inch long, can do that, why couldn't a dinosaur? Or some reptile? Why couldn't he have some chemicals that he mixes up? And then when his enemy approaches him, boom, you see, and this time out of his nose instead of out of his tail, and maybe they really were dragons. As a matter of fact, there's a number of dinosaurs which have hollow structures on top of their heads. The duckbill dinosaurs particularly have many strange different kinds of structures. The old hatchet head that has that sort of a hatchet-shaped structure up there, and there were others that have these hollow structures on the top of their head. And there's a tube leading from that structure down to the nostrils. And nobody really knows what the function were, whether they were, you know, involved in storage of air so they could maybe stay underwater a little bit longer, or whether they was involved in especially sensitive smell and so forth. Nobody knows. We don't know. I'm going to suggest, now I'm just going to say this is pure speculation, just guessing, maybe these things were dragons. And maybe that's where they stored the chemicals. I don't know. It's a wild suggestion, perhaps, but it's going to be an interesting one. It is one for kids, you see, at least. It'll fire up their imagination. I mean, if you can talk about UFOs coming from outer space and Van Daniken, Chariot of the Gods, and warm-blooded dinosaurs with fur and feathers and all that thing, I don't know why you can't talk about dragons. At least you've got the mechanism and you've got the structure. So we're going to suggest something like that anyhow. Yeah.
Could you explain the fact that you have models that you can't explain or relate model structures to homologous genes in terms of chromosomal transformations where you have the...
What you were suggesting, perhaps, that it may be possible to explain homologous structures due to a chromosomal arrangement rather than a genetic or a particular gene. Well, this, I don't know about that. I think that even evolutionists would hesitate to try something like that, because a structure generally can be related back to a structural gene. You see, you've got to have structural genes generally to explain structures, structural genes to explain protein structures. And it is assumed, of course, in homologous structures that you have muscle and you have bone and things like that, which are structural in nature, and somewhere back in there must be some structural gene, but they cannot find the structural gene, the identical gene. Now if one may try to get around this by some suggestion like this, but I you've got to get back to the structural gene somehow, somewhere, arranged on the chromosome. I doubt if it would be possible. Yes?
How do you explain then the origin of the Hulk here and its similarity to the wing, the diptera? The second wing in the fly has been shown to be genetically controlled and spontaneously popped from a Hulk here, which is a balance structure, into a full-fledged wing.
I didn't quite hear the suggestion there. You said there are wings on flies which develop, which come from what, did you say?
The order of diptera has two wings.
Yeah.
And behind those two wings are a pair of structures which are balancing structures. They are not wings at all. They don't look like them. Morgan has shown that spontaneously there will be offspring of these flies in which those structures are replaced by fully functional wings.
Well, in that case, what you're saying is this, well, you have two sets of wings and there's another structure which you say under certain circumstances would develop into wings. Now, is this a genetic change or a developmental change? Genetic is under genetic control, but you're not saying that these are mutations. What are they saying? How does this change take place? I don't know. I'm just not familiar with the data, so I could not comment on that because I'm just simply not familiar with the data on this particular case that you're suggesting. Now, whether it's something similar to metamorphosis, where, of course, you have new structures developing, that wouldn't be true wouldn't correspond to metamorphosis, because in metamorphosis, structures develop from entirely different tissues. As a matter of fact, I understand in some larvae, animals with metamorphs, that laid down side by side in the larvae are the cells, which are now, say, responsible for gills, laid right down side by side, but totally independent of the cells that were going to develop in the lungs later. They're there present. They're laid down side by side. Though that wouldn't be metamorphosis. I can't comment on that because I'm just not familiar with the data. T.H. Morgan is the man I assume you're referring to. He was an evolutionist, but he he displayed his impatience with these people who were always working on phylogenies and so forth. He considered it a waste of time, and he had he didn't have too much respect for people who try to go through all this sort of thing. I can't comment any further on that. Maybe I should recheck this thing by Gavin De Beer and see if he discusses that particular thing. Yes, I don't recall, so I don't think he did.
I've heard that frogs have more DNA per cell than human beings.
Yes, I'm not sure. I know there are many animals supposed to be simpler, way, way, way down the evolutionary line, to have more DNA than man does. It does not follow any pattern whatsoever, and the number of chromosomes follow no pattern. Dr. John Moore of Michigan State has done quite a bit of research on this, and he gave a paper, as a matter of fact, at the AAAS meeting at the Society for the Study of Evolution, pointing this out. And now there are some types of DNA which they call redundant or something like that. They're trying to account for this fact. There's just no pattern. Let's put it this way. There's no pattern of increasing DNA. Well, there's some pattern, but there's so many contradictions. Yes?
Have there been any modifications of the basic one gene, one enzyme hypothesis?
Very definitely. The question is, has there been a modification of one gene, one enzyme hypothesis? Now, I think in some cases, the structural genes, there is one gene, maybe one enzyme, although I'm not sure whether that's still around or not. But we do know that most characteristics are controlled and governed by many genes. And each one of these genes involved in the control or elaboration of that characteristic also affect many other characteristics. The genetic apparatus is incredibly complex. You see, if you just had one gene controlling each characteristic, then you might imagine some way possible might be able to modify that gene to affect the characteristic in some useful way. But when you realize that characteristic is not controlled by a single gene, but maybe 15, 20, or 30 genes, and then each one of these, say, 15 genes are also involved in the control of other characteristics, and gene A and gene B may control characteristic Z, we'll say, but gene A also controls characteristic B, and gene B controls characteristic H, and so you find that this genetic apparatus is absolutely incredibly complex. And try to imagine just random changes in the genes that's going to affect the characteristic in some favorable way when it's under the control of a number of genes. And you've got to change that gene so it'll change one characteristic in a favorable way without affecting the other characteristics that it governs in an unfavorable way. Well, it's absolutely incredible. And then there must be control mechanisms. And some of these genes, some of the gene complexes are located on different chromosomes. They're complexes of genes controlling the characteristic. We find them on different chromosomes. Now, if you're going to change this chromosome here by inversion or something like that, you're going to affect some of those genes here, but not these over here. And you're going to change this characteristic in a favorable way? Well, no, you're not going to do that. What you're going to do, you're going to wreck the apparatus. That's all there is to it. When you make a random change in an incredibly complex structure, you get bad things, don't you? You can't stand back and throw a wrench at an automobile engine and make any improvement. One time I was, by the way, this was at Wheaton College, I was invited to participate in an annual symposium, and this symposium was on the future of man. The featured speaker at this symposium at Wheaton College, by the way, was Dr. Harvey Bender of Notre Dame University. Made no profession of being a Christian whatsoever. As a matter of fact, he said in his address that he's basing the future of man on the fact that man had evolved. And nothing to do with what the Bible had to say about the future, man. We've had an evolutionary history. Now we're going to look in the future and see what our future is. That was the featured preacher, the featured speaker at Wheaton College. Well, he was that mixed up, I think. But what kind of shook me up is this is the man Wheaton College wanted to speak to their students, talk about the future man. Beg pardon?
I'm concerned about that.
Well, it's too bad. I did have an opportunity to appear on a panel, and during the question and answer period, one of the students asked Dr. Bender, well, Dr. Bender, if mutations are responsible for evolution, why are scientists so dreadfully afraid of mutations. In other words, why don't we have these mutations and get on with this grand scheme? Well, Dr. Bender said, let me put it this way. He said, if I took my watch and laid it here on the floor, then I got an ice pick and I put it right above the watch and dropped it on the watch, the chances of improving the mechanism by that procedure would be just as great as the chance of improving the mechanism of a cell by a mutation. So I got to the microphone and I said, Dr. Bender says, I'm not an evolutionist, I'm a creationist. This gives me an opportunity to say something. Now, if the chances of improving the mechanism of a cell by a mutation is no greater than that, than dropping an ice pick on a watch to improve the mechanism of a watch, I said, you've got no chance at all. I mean, no way the mutation is going to cause any evolutionary changes. But this is what Bender said. Well, I guess we are out of time. All right, let's take a break.